Welcome back to Community Nulu, the fortnightly segment. I'm your host, Nelson Aldridge. And it's fair to say that on Community Nulu, we've had some pretty amazing guests in our 12 months we've been doing this now. We've had some AFL players, some AFL board members, CEO of mental health companies and organisations, and just some ripping community members in general. But today might be the pinnacle of my of Community Nulu in general, to be honest. They don't get too much bigger than this. It's an amazing guest today. We've got someone who's coming from one of the most popular Australian bands of all time. He is a talented producer, mix engineer and composer, as well as a successful performer in his own right. He achieved international success in all these roles with Australian pop group Pseudo Echo. The Shoots achieved top 10 hit singles and albums, reaching gold and platinum status, as well as producing the worldwide smash hit of Funky Town, receiving numerous national and international music awards. He has experience in many other fields, including jingle writing, sound design, artist development and management. His jingle production company, Mumbo Jumbo Music, has produced work for all major advertising agencies, including clients such as Just Jeans, Coca-Cola, Heinz, Kraft, Mobil, BP, Peters, Fisher & Price, LG, Austereo and many more. It is quite evident that this person's diversity and musical direction clearly has no boundaries, and it is my absolute privilege and honour to welcome to the show the one and only Brian Canema. Welcome to Community Nulu, Brian.
Wow, that was a big intro. Thank you, Nels.
That's the biggest intro I've ever done, but I think it's very fitting for what we're doing today.
Thank you.
So, Brian, look, the first question I usually ask is, it's a little thing called Who's Your Mob, Where You're From, and it's essentially just the guest telling people a little bit their life growing up, where they might have grown up, where they went to school, maybe their first job. So let's get this underway.
Wow, okay. Well, from birth to the age of four, I was in West Heidelberg. So I was mixing it with the Tuffies, and that was a good starting point. And I have incredibly vivid memories of my time at that young age in West Heidelberg. And I've even written a song about the street that I lived in, and called Liberty Parade, which I did with my band Brill some years later. And then I really spent most of my sort of childhood and teenage years in Bundoora, in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. Bundoora then was a squeaky clean, new young couples sort of estate, all young families. And that was my main background, where I really have my roots. So I have a real fond association of the northern suburbs of Melbourne. And and it wasn't until I got into my 20s that I actually up and left home. And then I'd started my music career. Prior to that, I reckon my high school years, I was still at Greenwood High School I went to, which is now called Bundoora College, I believe. I did Greenwood Primary School before that. Same, just right next door to each other. And then as I was getting into my later teens, I changed schools because I went to McLeod High School, and they had a much better music program, and I started sort of get a bit more serious about the music. I left school when I was probably only 17, maybe 18. Actually 18, because I drove my little Datsun 180 B to high school every now and then.
Beautiful.
Thought I was like the Fonz. And so then I got a job with my father. My father had a furniture business called Christian Furniture, and I was a cabinet maker and a furniture stainer, polisher. So I sort of worked my way around all the tradie stuff there. That was great. And I did that, and that was very sort of versatile, because I was able to maintain my job and then still have this sort of hobby, which was becoming my profession, as music. And I was fortunate enough for my dad in the big factory he had there in West Heidelberg. He had an office upstairs that was quite a big space, and he gave me that space and said, you can just have that for your band. And that was incredible. So I decked it all out like a studio, and we had our gear permanently set up there. And we used to practice, three or four times a week. That was kind of our main pastime.
Yeah.
So I was very lucky to have a day job at the place where my rehearsal room was, and have that flexibility to just duck up if I had an idea and start, putting down notes and recording things during work hours, of course. And then, my mates would all meet me there after work, and we'd bang it away. So it was an incredible advantage for me. And by the time I was sort of in my early 20s, I realised the music scene, I needed to get out of the suburbs and move into town, because that's where there was a real scene happening. And I moved into South Yarra when I was about 20, 21. And that's when things really started happening. I got, like, you got to remember the bands that I started when I was 17. It wasn't really Pseudo Echo. It was they were different bands. I had Osralite, The Lights, Secret Agents, and one of the guys in Pseudo Echo, Pierre, he was with me from high school, so he stayed in those bands all the time. And it took us a fair while to just get personnel right too. You know, it takes a while to get the members. So when I hit my 20s, moved into South Yarra, I started networking, and that's where I started meeting all the right people, and that's where Pseudo Echo was kind of born then.
Yeah, awesome. Did you always play guitar growing up?
Well, I started on bass. Bass was my first instrument because I thought six strings looked way too complicated and too many things to try and hold the strings down all at once playing chords, so I figured bass was a better idea to get cracking. And I'd already started sort of noodling around on a half-beaten-up acoustic guitar at home and kind of playing with my thumb more than my fingers. My technique was so bad, but I'd learn a couple of, you know, like a Rolling Stones riff and a Deep Purple riff, and I started to go, okay, I think I've got this. It was one string I was mastering at least, and then I sort of progressed from there, and I think that's where the bass came into it. I thought I really liked the pentatonic kind of riffs and things that I was hearing from the 70s, and it seemed like a natural thing to start on bass.
Yeah, cool. Before we get into Pseudo Echo and how that really started to kick off and all that, you know, your musical influences growing up, we had a bit of a chat before we come onto the air, which was really cool, but who were your influences in music?
Well, I think going back to into the 70s, which is my main influential period because, that was my teen years, and it's really broad, really, because there's the early stuff where I was obviously into Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, you know, Slade. God, you know, there were so many because I grew up in a household with five boys. I've got four older brothers. So they all had their individual taste in music. And we had this fantastic, eclectic record collection. And so I could just, you know, sift through it. And it was like being in a record store. You know, there were so many different, you know, versatility of music that I'm just, you know, I just usually go by the cover art. You know, I'd flick through and go, I like this one, and then I just throw it on and have a listen, and, you know, half the time I might go, this is great, sometimes I wouldn't like it. So I found my way through that collection, and that really moulded my taste in music. And then there was always obviously Beatles and even bits of Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, of course. And they were all just things that were in that collection. And so I was lucky enough, you know, to have that flexibility.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. Yeah, I'm only 26, but I think that was my influences in music to get to, as we were speaking about.
Well, your dad did a good job there.
He did. Mum and Dad did a great job. So Pseudo Echo. So the band formed in 1982?
That's right.
Okay, so how did that come about? I want to know who named the band too. And how did that kick off? Where did you start playing your first gigs?
Well, I guess, you know, I had this band, Osralite was my first band with Pierre.
Yep.
And that sort of came out of high school, pretty much. It was a good way of getting out of work, and we could do concerts during school hours and all that stuff. So we loved the idea of that. And so we eventually, the new wave thing was starting to happen, post-punk. There's this new wave sound happening, and they're all called, you know, The Something. Mm. Every band was called. So we took off Osralite and we called it The Lights. Mm-hmm. And then we just sort of modified the production of the sound of the songs. So instead of being the traditional cheesy pop songs that we were writing then, we just kind of heavied them up a bit and then simplified them and made them sound a bit edgier. And we pushed our way with that sound for a while. Then we changed our name again to The Secret Agents. I don't know where we came with that, but that was what we called it. And that started to sort of happen a bit for us. We got thrown on a few local festivals and things like that, Blue Lights and a couple of those. So it was looking good. You know, things were going up. And then it wasn't until we dropped that name and then we said we could hear a new thing happening in music once again. And that was that electronica, new romantic sound was starting to happen. It was really early days in the early 80s and hadn't really kicked into it in Australia, but some of my brother's friends were, you know, dropping off albums to our place, to this big collection we had, and, you know, check this one out. And there were bands like, you know, Simple Minds, Human League, Gary Newman, Kraftwerk, all this sort of early electronica. And so that was starting to influence me then, and I could see this was a new wave again happening. And so I thought, I need to get on the wave before everyone gets on it. And so I was really listening intently to this music. And then I realised the one thing we needed was keyboards. I said, we don't have a keyboard player. You know, nobody in the 70s bloody played keyboards. They played bass, drums and guitar. So
the search for a keyboard player started, because I thought, if I get keyboards, I'll be able to get that sound of this sound I'm hearing internationally. And eventually, Pierre and I were introduced through a series of events of different bands and things that we opened for, a keyboard player called Tony Lugton, who went on to be Pseudo's keyboard player. And Tony was really a guitarist, just took on keyboards, you know, a couple of fingers here and there, and he was learning his way. And so that was enough. That was more than we knew. And then as we started to mould this sound, I realised the bass was the next thing. The bass guitar was sounding kind of traditional, and I wanted a more electronic, edgy sound. When I was listening to Human League and some of these bands, I said, they're not using bass guitar. They're using a keyboard or something, a synth. Mm. So what we did is we just got Pierre, who was a traditional bass player, never played keyboard. We just bought this little Prophet keyboard and said, OK, we're going to make some bass sounds and you're going to play your bass on here. So he had to learn keyboards. Yeah, so both keyboard players learnt as they were forming Pseudo Echo. Wow. And the name... When we had all these keyboards, they had operator manuals, because in those days it was all manual. You couldn't just push a button and there was a sound. You had to make the sound.
Yep.
And, you know, you had to remember where all the dials were pointed to. So that the manual would usually give you a bunch of example sounds. One of the sounds was called Pseudo Echo Machine.
Yep.
And as we were tossing around ideas for a band, for a name, Tony, our keyboard player, he was just turning the page and he got to that page and he said, "What's Pseudo Echo Machine?" You know, that was the name of that sound. Yeah. And he just happened to be on it, right? And we just looked at him and went, "That's a good name for a band."
Yeah.
And so we just dropped the machine bit, hence why we've used it for this tour. But yeah, so we just said, "Pseudo Echo, great, we love it."
Pseudo Echo, the rest is history.
Yeah, and that was it from that day.
That's a gross name. And it stuck.
It stuck, all right. Yeah, there wasn't really even another contender. It was pretty much it.
No, that's great. So you took off, Pseudo Echo took off, you started playing. And so in 1983, I believe, Countdown, Molly Meldrum.
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
Well, Pierre and I, at the age of 18, we used to go to a club in the northern suburbs called The Croc in Croxton Park. And Molly used to DJ there on a Thursday night. And he played good stuff, progressive, yeah, really modern, cutting edge. And it was always, you know, in front of what else was going on. And so I really went for that. I used to just go and listen to what he played and make note of the dance floor and see how people reacted. Because I figured, you know, we're starting a band, we needed to start absorbing what's going on, what's getting the crowds going. And somebody introduced me to Molly one night. And that was kind of, you know, a bit novel, you know, shook his hand and went, "Oh, yeah, good." it's like some little shy kid. And then he was really nice to me. And then some years later, fast forward a few years, Pseudo Echo's up and running. We're playing some clubs and opening for acts and even started doing our own headlines. And a mutual friend had gotten one of our demo tapes to Molly. And sort of he pricked his ears and he said, "Yeah, I like this." And she told us that the feedback was good and he wanted to pop into a gig sometime. But she didn't say when. Just said, at some point. So we were doing this show at the Jump Club in Melbourne, in Smith Street, in Fitzroy. And it was a really hip club, you know. It attracted all the real goth-looking, you know, new romantic crowd. And we were pulling pretty good numbers. You know, we might have had 100, 200 people there at our show. And we weren't signed or anything. They were good numbers to be getting along to your own show. And that was the night I saw the cowboy hat appear in the crowd. And I just was so excited. I thought, my God, Molly Meldrum's at our gig. You know, it felt like we'd really arrived. So after the show, Molly came back with a big posse and introduced himself and sort of chatted to us. And then he realised the penny dropped and he said, "I know you." He said, "You're that kid who used to come to my club every Thursday night and sit on the sidelines and listen to me DJing." And so that was a nice connection, because he'd known me as this sort of, you know, introverted, shy kid. And all of a sudden I'm this, outlandish front man of Pseudo Echo. So it was quite novel. And I think he was really taken back. He thought the gig was great and gave us a lot of compliments. And he just sort of left it at that. But within the next week, we got a call to our manager, who must have liaised with Molly and exchanged numbers. And Molly said, "I want to put you on Countdown." And, like, that was the most surreal conversation I'd ever had on the phone, my manager telling me that. And I'm thinking, what the hell? We don't even have a record deal, let alone a single out.
Yeah.
And so Molly just took it on his own back. And you know, it was against policy of the ABC to put any band on unless they had a major record deal, because they couldn't just have every Tom, Dick and Harry on the show, so they had to draw the line. But I think Molly just went out on a limb. He was really so confident that he'd found something, and he wanted to be, you know, the champion who was going to present us to Australia and to the world ultimately. So he did just that. He invited us in. You lip sync to a performance. Yeah. So we recorded a new demo of Listening. He said, "You just pick whatever song you want. I like them all." So we were impressed with that. But we picked Listening, and we went into the ABC after hours. There was no audience in there or anything. It was just the crew in there moonlighting, and they set up a whole stage for us, and they went all out, put some props up, and, you know, did some multi-camera angle, you know, editing and fancy stuff, and made it look good with some special effects. And then Molly took that recording and presented it on primetime TV on Countdown one night. And it was July 21, if I remember rightly. And he just did this big spiel, introduced us to the world and said, "Check them out. We think they're great. See what you think." And then played our clip of Listening. And it was just a sensation. Like, the feedback they got was so overwhelming, and we were so surprised. We couldn't believe it. And within the month, we had record companies banging on our door and, you know, bidding against each other, and ultimately we signed a deal with EMI.
Yeah, so Listening was probably a really good choice too, because that went on.
Yeah, it was a great choice.
Went hit number 4 in the Australian charts,
yeah.
I believe.
And the funny thing is when we used to perform it live, we used to do it halftime.
Yeah.
And it was really dramatic and dark. Oh. And then it just perked up for the chorus. But the verses were all dark, so luckily, just before we did it on Countdown, we decided we'd change the tempo and step it up, so it was all upbeat.
Yep.
And so that was a good move too.
Yeah, awesome. And you've said that you were signed to EMI Records, which would have been quite surreal, getting that phone call.
Absolutely.
The record label. And then in 1984, you went on to release your debut album, Autumnal Park.
Yep.
Correct.
Yep.
Yes. It had tracks on it such as A Beat For You, Dancing Until Midnight and Stranger In Me. How did that feel to get that debut album out there?
Oh, like a lifetime accomplishment,
yeah.
at 21 years old. Absolutely amazing. Like, you know, you've got to remember, back then it wasn't like how it is now where, you know, everybody has the opportunity to make an album or put stuff on Spotify and be heard by the world. Back then, that wasn't the case. Only those who were signed to major labels really did record, because you couldn't record at home. There were no computers, there were no digital recording. It was all big, clunky, gigantic equipment in a purpose-built studio, which costs, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. So it wasn't possible. You either got to record in some B-grade, little crappy little studio with your demos, and the next step up was a big step.
Yep.
So we'd done a couple of those sort of low-budget demos, and you know, they have their certain sound, which wasn't like records. We knew it sounded different. We didn't know why it sounded different, but it just did.
Yep.
And then when we went to do the record and the album in EMI Studios in Sydney, these are iconic studios. It's on a Neve console. It's like one of the most iconic consoles in the history of music. And, you know, it's a beautiful traditional studio. So for us to go in, you know, with our little songs, get a producer and give us some ideas and rearrange the songs and rethink them and look at them from a different perspective, and then just keep adding to them until they sounded like a proper record, was just an incredible experience.
Yeah, and the journey began, and then I imagine, you know, things would have taken off in the touring, started probably getting a few more gigs,
yeah,
I'd
well,
say.
Well, we were surprised that everything just kept going,
yeah,
positive. It just,
yeah,
kept evolving and moving in a positive direction. You know, the first single was a smash, considering,
yes,
and we had no idea that would happen. The second single was a smash, and then the album was a smash. You know, it went gold straight away. We couldn't believe it, what was happening. And then, you know, our numbers are multiplying. You know, we moved from being a little opening act to being a headline act, national touring. You know, my first interstate trip was with Pseudo Echo. I was, you know, in my 20s, early 20s, and we drove from Melbourne to Sydney to do our first show, and I sat in the middle seat on the back bench seat of some little two-door coupe for 10 hours until I think we got there, and then we did our gig.
Wow.
and stayed in some B-grade little crappy hotel.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was so exciting. You know, it's like, yeah, we're playing to people who've from another state. It was such a big deal to us back then.
I guess it's kind of like lightning in a bottle, isn't it?
Ah, it was incredible. It really was.
Because you went on from 1984 releasing your debut album to then in 1985 releasing your second, which was Love and Adventure.
That's right.
with tracks on it such as Don't Go, Living in a Dream and Try. Is that when you, like, you know, that lightning in a bottle feeling of, cap, you know, jumping on the back of something, keeping this momentum going, and did it really start to take off then?
Yeah, it did. And also we were growing musically, you know, we were evolving. You know, we were young kids and then we were young men. And so there were a couple of lineup tweaks. Tony left the band and then we got James Lee in the band, and James was just a young kid. He was fresh out of high school. And I remember thinking, this will be good. This will be a good injection for the band. A younger member brings the average age down, gives it a fresh appeal. He was a good-looking young kid and he had great musical attributes. And so I started writing with him too, which was a new songwriting combo. And for that album, we really unleashed a lot of potential that we had. You know, the first album was cumulative over many years from my teenage years, and then to get to that point, whereas the Love and Adventure album was pretty much written in the year. There were a couple of older songs that had been hanging around. Living in a Dream in particular was a real old one that I'd written when I was a teenager. But yeah, so there was this, it was a real kind of focused album, and I think the focus was on popular popular success, really. It really was. We knew we had an audience and we knew we were in a pretty good position, and we didn't want to mess around and try to be too cool for school. We just thought, let's just get to the point and write some killer pop songs.
And that you did. And that you did. And what we'll do now is we'll jump to a quick break. We're going to play some Pseudo Echo songs, actually. Okay. And then when we come back, it would be reminiscent for us to not talk about the cover of Funky Town and the heights that went to. Sure. So we'll jump to a quick break and we'll be right back after these tracks. We'll be right back.
Valley FM acknowledges the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri people, as the custodians of this land we broadcast from. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley.
Welcome back to Community Nulu. We're here with Brian Canham. And Brian, before the break, we were talking about your life growing up and, you know, finding Pseudo Echo and your first couple of albums. And we're up to 1986 now, which, as I said, it'd be reminiscent to not talk about the big hit of the cover of Funky Town. Oh, it's probably fair to say that the cover is almost probably more popular than the original, really.
Yeah, I think it eclipsed it eventually.
Yeah, eventually. But how did that come about? Whose idea was that?
It was my idea. It was interesting how it really came about, because as I was saying, in my earlier years I used to go to this club with Molly DJing, and that's where I first heard the original version of Funky Town. And it had such an impact on me when he played it, because he must have played it when it was brand new, wasn't in the charts yet or anything like that. And it had such an impact on me, the way that the bass went, the simplicity of it. I could hear the big fat bass, you know, this one solitary guitar part in the chorus, and the poppy little synth line. It was all really sort of separated and simple, and there was something about it, contagiousness of the beat. And so that just stuck with me. And then some years later, when I was in the middle of the tour for the Love and Adventure album, I had a coffee with a friend. He was a DJ, and he had all his vinyl collection. And while we're having coffee, he just put on some tracks that we remembered when we were clubbing, when we were kids. And he puts on Funky Town. And I just, straight away, it had this real nostalgic effect on me. You got to remember when you're 25, you know, 5 years earlier is pretty nostalgic for the amount of time you've been on the planet. So it was like, oh, we're going way back now. I listened to it intently, and it was such an amazing nostalgia listening to it. And so the next sound check I was doing, which would have been like the next day or something, because we were in the middle of the tour while I was listening to this, the next sound check, I just started sort of noodling on guitar and playing the parts of the original Funky Town. And I couldn't sing it because it was in too high a key for me. So I sort of had to go all the way down. I said, well, I've got to go up or I've got to go down, but somehow it's miles away from where I sing. So I ended up right down the end of the guitar in the low E, and so it sounded this real grungy. And then I just literally mucking around with some riffs and bits and pieces and really loosely mimicked the original song. And Pierre already knew it because we used to go together. And so he started joining in and we started singing it. And before you know it, we're playing Funky Town at soundcheck, a kind of a loose, rocky version. And that night in the encore, it was unanimous. We said, hey, let's just jam it. Let's just do Funky Town, see how we go. So we did it, and it brought the house down. Like, it was such a good response that we put it in the encore for the rest of the tour. And then what happened is Lee Simon, head of Triple M, or was Eon FM back in the day, he'd somehow gotten himself a tape of it. Somebody must have smuggled one off a desk tape to him. And we used to share an office with the guys at Eon FM. Their radio station was in the same building as our management, and which was the Wheatley organisation. And one day I'm just walking down the corridor and I see Lee in the corridor, and he says to me, he stops me and he's all excited, and he said, you've got to release that song. It's a smash. Like this. And I didn't really know what he was talking about. I didn't know he had this tape of it. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, Funky Town. I said, how do you know about that? He goes, oh, I've got a tape of it. Huh. And I said, cool. I said, all right, you like it, hey? And he said, yeah, I love it. He goes, it's a smash. He goes, you'll have a number one for sure. I remember his words, the way he said that. So I went straight into the office, talking to Glenn, our manager. I said, I just bump into Lee, and, he's all excited. So I think, Glenn could get that vibe, thinking, well, hang on, ahead of the radio station, things to hit. I reckon we got something here. And I remember Glenn calling up our American label, because we do everything sort of in sync. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to know about it. They just said, that's a daggy idea. You know, that disco's dead. Because they just remembered the original. Yeah, and they're going, oh, no, you can't be doing that. You guys are crazy. But I already knew how it was going down with our audience. So I just said, we are going to record this. And if I'm getting the top of the radio station next door telling me that he thinks it's going to be a hit, I'm buying it. So I just went on and just said, I don't care who's going to stand behind me. I'm going to go and do it. So we actually just literally commandeered the studio, went in, EMI Australia were behind it. They said, yeah, good idea. We think you're onto something.
Yep.
And so I took the helm of producer, which was kind of the first official role. I'd always been the co-producer of Sudos, but I'd never credited myself or taken it officially. But this time I did. And so it was a real experience. We went into the studio, we thrashed it around, we progressed it a bit. We had this big long intro that was all sort of moody and sounded like something off Dark Side of the Moon, and then at the 11th hour we cut that off and just threw it. The tape was gone and we said, no, that's going. And strangely enough, on the outro of the song, I was just jamming on the guitar, playing these big power chords, and then I started kind of mimicking the riff of the original string line, which is like do 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 do, and then I sort of just sort of fluked onto this riff, down 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 down, and that's going away in the background. And so as we were cutting together the extended mix of Funky Town, because we'd do it at the same time, once we had the settings set up for that mix,
yeah,
we'd then do run off a whole bunch of stuff to another piece of tape and then compose it and piece it all together. But there was this one section that was, as I said, I was noodling away at the outro of the song, and because I was playing that guitar riff, we just sort of stumbled on. I put the kick drum on and I had just the guitar and I turned everything off, and then that became what we hear now as the intro of Funky Town. And so we decided we'd cut that on to the front and take off the arty start and just get straight into it.
Well, it definitely, although you were told it was going to be a smash hit, did you expect it to get as big as it did?
I don't think I ever anticipated stuff in that way. No. I never really saw it like that. I just thought, let's just do the best we can do with this and see how it goes, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we were surprised when it, you know, because there was some negative response too. There was, you know, like I said, the American label weren't into it at all. They just thought it was a dumb idea. So it was only when it charted here that they said, hey, that's a great idea. Let's get on that too.
Yeah.
So luckily it was a hit, because I was taking a big risk there doing it on my own.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, let's jump forward to 1990. The band, you know, disbanded.
Yeah.
And you went into the production side of music. You talked a little bit about producing Funky Town and doing a little bit before that, but what made you really want to get into that production side of the industry?
I think that, well, firstly, I'd kind of almost had enough of being a public figure and a pop star. That was kind of starting to encroach in my private life and my personal life, and it was getting a bit tiresome. I was struggling a bit personally with it, because I was just a musician at heart. I wasn't really designed to be a pop star when I was that young, and I thought that I loved making music, but I realised that it came with a certain amount of notoriety when you had success with it. And so I think that that's how I became more interested in the production side. I just wanted to make the music, not necessarily be the music and be the artist. So I did a stint, as you mentioned earlier, of doing jingle production, which I kind of liked. It's not the sexiest job, but it's kind of, you know, it's not real rock and roll, but I learned a lot about business. I learned a lot about how to operate a business and run my own business and how to liaise with people. I'd never done any of that. I went straight from school, little stint as a cabinet maker, and then I was a pop star overnight, kind of thing. So I hadn't had a lot of work experience in that sort of side of it. So it was a great experience for me, and I did it for quite a few years, and it was a lucrative business, and I really honed my skill doing it, you know, being able to work to a brief and do this. But then I did get tired of it and thought, you know, who am I talking to here? I've got some, you know, snotty nose young kids telling me how it's meant to be this way and that way. And I thought, well, there was a point where I did this job, and one of the big CEOs came and he said, he listened to it, and then he listened to my showreel, which was all my sort of previous jobs, and he just flatly looked at me and he said, I don't think you're the right guy for the job. Mm. And then he just walked out. And,
wow.
And that was in front of a whole creative team and myself. And so I sort of was crushed. I just thought, oh, God, you know, this is terrible. And luckily, one of the women that I was working with, who was worked at the firm, she really believed in it. So she stood by me and said, no, you're going to do the job, and I know you'll do it right. Turns out I won an award for that job. and I saw that guy at the award thing later on, shook my hand and said, good job there, young man.
Yeah.
And And so I that kind of gave me a bit of a push up. You know, I really felt thought about things, and that's when I made the decision that I'd probably had enough of doing the jingles, and I said I need to be an artist again or get back into the music side. And that's where I went from there. Rather than being an artist again, I went more into music production for bands.
Yep.
And that's when I produced Chocolate Starfish. I did some work with Taxi Ride, Shantuzzi's, Lee Kernaghan, as I mentioned earlier, which is an unusual one for me. But I did, I worked with a really diverse bunch of artists, and that was great. I really liked it. I was sort of involved in the songwriting, the arranging, the producing, I'd play a bit on their songs, I'd sing a bit on the backing vocals sometimes on some of the stuff I worked on, and I really liked that side of it.
Well, you did Chocolate Starfish's debut album.
Yeah, first two albums I did with them. They were great. That was a great experience for me. It was very nostalgic. I went back into the same studio that I did the Autumnal Park album in. They had signed to EMI as well. So that was really a nice kind of warm, fuzzy feeling going back onto the same console, into the same studio, now as a big producer instead of the artist. But that had its pitfalls too, because, as an artist, you're getting kissed up to and patted on the back all the time, and everyone wants your autograph and take a photo with you. And as a producer, that doesn't happen at all. They quickly push you aside and shake the hand of the artist, and you're not going to get any kudos out of it at all. Not that I needed it, but it's an unusual dynamic change. And I can remember one of the albums that I did with Chocolate Starfish, we were at a big event launching it, and they got another guy to work on the album with me, who was an engineer, he was a sound engineer, and I was still the producer. And at the sort of ceremony, they did was thank that guy, the big wig who'd worked with Bruce Springsteen and all this, and he was a lovely guy. And he got up there, and the first thing he said, he goes, you don't need to thank me, you need to thank Brian, he's the producer. And it really rung home with me. I realised that all of a sudden you're really getting pushed off to the side sometimes. You don't always get your accolades that people think you're going to get.
Yeah.
And so I struggled with that for a while in the background, just being a producer. I liked the producing and the making music, but I felt a little bit shunted aside almost as like an old shoe. He's just sort of pushed aside. So I think that's part of the drive again to get me back into music and as an artist again.
Yeah, and now that we've mentioned that, getting back into the music and artist, Pseudo got back together in 98, was it?
Yeah, so off the back of one of the Starfish albums I was doing, we went out to a club one night, and the guys all said, you got to come to this club. This is while we're making their second album. And they said, you got to come to this club. It's an 80s club. They'll love you. You'll love it. And I thought it was a bit novel. Anyway, we go to this club. There's a big queue outside, and it's hard to get in. So the guys in the Chocolate Starfish are up the front trying to get in. And they're kind of relatively still kind of newish. And especially in that circle of the 80s, they didn't really know who they were. But the manager was apparently standing at the front of the queue just talking to some security and recognised me. And so I got them all in instead of them getting me in. And as we got into the club, it was weird. It was like going back in time. Everyone was, partying onto all the 80s music. Mm-hmm. And it was like I was popular again. And so the manager comes up and he said, have you ever thought about putting the band back together? And I said, look, I haven't spoken to half the guys and some of them are doing other things and we've all gone off in our own direction. He said, well, let's swap numbers and I want to talk to you more about this. And this went on for about another 12 months. He'd call me and try and talk me around into seeing if I could do it. And so one year, it was 97, 98, end of 97, he calls me up and he says, we have a big do New Year's Eve this year. We had the Pointer Sisters and they've pulled out at the 11th hour. Could you do it with Pseudo Echo? Mind you, that was Pointer Sisters' money too, so yep. it was a pretty tempting gig.
Yep.
And I said, look, if there's going to be a time, this is it. So let me see what I can do. So I called up Pierre. He was on board. The other guys, none of the other guys were around. They were all doing their own thing. So I put together a new band using one of the guys from Chocolate Starfish, a guy from Bad Loves. So I had this little four-piece, few old hats, and spent some months, going through all the sounds and relocating bits and pieces of equipment, and because I really wanted it to be a real banger. I wanted it to sound like the real deal. So we did this gig to about 2,000 people, and it was a massively, hugely successful gig. It brought the house down, and I reckon the phone started ringing the next day. And, you know, all the agencies had copped hold of it. The word got around, and before you knew it, we were doing clubs again with this new version of Pseudo Echo, and we were selling them out everywhere. Like, and it wasn't even really planned. It just happened, and before you know it, we're back on it.
Wow. That's so awesome. And what's Pseudo Echo doing today? So we were talking before that it's the 40th year anniversary of Autumnal Park, and you were doing a bit of a remix with that album?
Yeah, I'm going to remix some of the songs off that one and some of the off pretty much all the singles that we released during the 80s. So I'm going to do those and a couple of surprises in there too, I guess. But, look, you know, through those years when I reformed it, the band evolved a lot, changed members a lot, and it kept sort of growing, and I kept finding my way with the right dynamics, because I realised the biggest thing that I needed in the band was the right dynamics, more than anything. It was the right people. They had the right attitude and want to do it for the right reasons. There's no point getting guys who just want to make a buck and they're just doing it as a job kind of thing, because it's never going to be the right passion, the right chemistry on stage. And I realised that the better you had the relationship with your members in your band, the better the performances were, the better the response from the audience.
Yeah.
They can feel that energy. They can say, these guys want to be together there. They're not just doing it for, make $5 at the end of the night.
Yeah.
They're up there because they love playing music. And that was really important to me. So I've been through a lot of members in Pseudo Echo. It's just been an evolution. But the lineup I have now, I've had some of the members for a good 10 years nearly, and there's some new... We've got a couple of girls in the band these days. It's a six-piece. We've got a young drummer who's only 20 years old, female drummer, and she's just dynamite. Raquel, my wife and manager, found her on Instagram and spotted her in the middle of our last tour when we were doing the Ultimate Tour last year.
Yep.
So Abby's the new one, and then there's Valentina, who's a vocalist with us now. She's fantastic. So I've got this young kind of band now, and the enthusiasm is incredible. These guys just love Pseudo Echo. They love the 80s, and they really embrace it with such pride that you can't help but notice that when we're playing. The audience just lap it up. They love it, and for me it's a real feeling of pride having these young guys perform my songs in such a authentic and faithful manner to the original, you know. So we're at this tour we're doing now, the Machine Tour, which the Machine is from the original handbook that we got the name from. We figured that was fitting for the anniversary, and we took it from the concerts last year that we were doing in the theatres, and we sort of compacted into a club show.
Yep.
Same visuals, big show for a club. You know, like I said, we have dancers sometimes, and you know, it's a six-piece band. It's fuller and bigger and vibey. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, awesome. I love what you said about when you get the right people and the connections made, the music is better.
It doesn't
matter if they're an original member or not.
Absolutely. You know, for years I struggled, and you know, a lot of fans would say, oh, where's the original guy? Who's the original this one? Where's this? And then sometimes I'd do that, and I'd get the original guys, and it was just terrible dynamics. Yeah. You know, cranky old men, and you know, don't want to be there, and you know, complaining about everything, and you know, jaded, and it's just terrible. Now, no, nothing personal about any members, because look, I get along with them all.
Yeah, I'm
okay with them all individual, but you know, it's got to be the right chemistry when they come together, and it's just no point, you know, doing it for the sake of saying, you know, these are the originals, but then it's a shit vibe.
Yeah.
So, I'm going for the right vibe.
And it's a good vibe.
Yeah.
And Brian, unfortunately, we're coming to an end of our show. It's incredible how quick an hour can go in the in-depth combo. But if there's one more thing I can ask of you, there's a lot of up-and-coming musicians and artists out there at the moment who, like it once upon a time, you were trying to make it, trying to get there.
Mm.
If there's any bit of advice you can give those artists and those young people coming through the ranks, what would it be?
Oh, I've got some advice for them. Okay. First thing is learn a lot about psychology and people.
Yep.
That's the first thing. Learn about your people. Second thing is choose the people you work with wisely. Take no compromise. If somebody's shitting you, don't work with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's no good. It'll never go anywhere. You've got to love each other. You've got to absolutely love each other and want the best for each other. And there can't be any envy or jealousy or anything. If one's getting more attention than another or whatever, embrace it.
Yeah.
Embrace it and make sure you know that that means it's good for your band, because for each person to be popular in their own right and successful, it's only better for the band. So the more heads together, the better it'll be.
I love that, though. I think in general, as humans, we quite often like to try and bring each other down.
Mm.
But, it, you know, I think it, it as a nation and as a people, that positiveness in life, you know, people coming together, embracing one another.
Absolutely.
That message is for everything, I think.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. Positive energy and being great with each other and respecting each other, it's paramount. Yeah. It is absolute top of the priority.
Yeah, totally. Well, Brian, look, it's been an absolute privilege to have you on the show today. I'm so grateful that you've given an hour of your time to come down to the studio and have a chat. Mate, as I said, it was an honour, it was a privilege. I love what you've done.
Thank you.
Your story, and I'm going to have to come watch you play because, you know, I love how it just keeps going too.
Thank you. And what a fine boy Mum and Dad have. I'm most impressed. Thanks, Nelson. Great chat to you.
No worries. Thank you, Brian. So that was Community Nulu for this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Have a great day, everyone.